Welcome to the TurfNet Renovation Report, brought to you by Golf Preservations and Capillary Flow. I'm Anthony Pioppi, your host. Joining me today is Eric Morrison. He's the golf course superintendent at Shinnecassa Golf Course in Groton, Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks, Tony, for having me.
So, Eric, it's December 18th. It's 49 degrees. Your course is on the water, so you get some of the ocean breeze, and you're on the Long Island Sound. You got to be packed today, are you?
Yes, we are slammed today. The tee sheet was full from 8 to 12:30. We had an hour and a half frost delay, so that stacked things up for us. So we had to use 1 and 10, and people are waiting around for an hour and a half, and they're not happy with me, but oh well.
And this all comes on the heels of you having an extremely wet week, right?
Oh, yeah. They were really mad at me yesterday because it was almost 50. It might have actually got over 50. And we couldn't open because it was too wet, and we had a sold-out tee sheet again. But yeah, we had over 4.5 inches of rain in the last week, so we were pretty wet.
And how many rounds will you do on a day like this?
Today, when almost 50, I mean, we could probably get close or over 100 rounds.
That's crazy. And you guys will stay open as long as the weather's warm, right?
Even if it's cold, as long as we don't have snow on the ground, we're open. I mean, if it's frozen solid, people still come out and play if it reaches the upper 30s, the low 40s.
Unbelievable.
And obviously we have the reputation in all of New England, really, that, you know, we're one of the few courses that keeps our greens open all winter.
Right, right.
But it seems the last few years, some other public courses have kind of gotten into our gig, and they keep their greens open too when they can, because we just haven't gotten real winters in like 5 years.
We haven't had real snow or real hard frost in at least 5 years.
You know, I had a nematode issue this summer, and Dr. Mikowski from Rhode Island tends to think that that's the reason. You know, every soil has nematodes, but it's just a matter of how big your population is. And he thinks without having a hard frost or freeze for the last few years, the populations have just increased every year.
So what I want to talk to you about is this renovation, what is really an unending renovation, bunker renovation thing that you have going on in your golf course. It's an interesting thing because golf goes back to 1898 there. You have a 1916 Donald Ross golf course. Nothing had been done to it until 2000. So Tim Garris, the architect, has a master plan in 2008, and you start working on bunkers after that. You got it to the course in 2001. Kind of do this. Tell me how the process after, you know, 90 years or 80 years of not doing a bunker renovation, that this municipal golf course decided that the town decided to do bunkers. How did that all come about?
Well, when I first got here, we put me and my boss, the director of Parks and Rec at the time, John Silsby, we put together a capital improvement program for the 5 years out, what we thought we needed to do. So that included both the golf course and the clubhouse. So the clubhouse was in a state of disrepair. The golf course is in a state of disrepair. They didn't do anything to it for all those years until they did the land swap. And with Pfizer in 97, they rearranged some holes and built some new holes. So those holes got irrigation. The other old part of the course that wasn't touched, fairways didn't have irrigation. So the fairways are getting baked out every year, which, you know, personally, I don't mind. Because of the link style course that we are, you kind of want it to play that way. So we did HVAC system in the clubhouse, and we got irrigation, new irrigation for the holes that were untouched in our first couple of years. So those were two huge projects. So then on the year's outlying, I wanted to address the golf course. So there were a number of tees. You know, the tees were built to host like 5,000 rounds in the summer.
Right. I mean, the course, we should talk about that. The course was part of the original, what was the Griswold Inn. And so it was this summertime vacation golf course. It wasn't a municipal golf course.
No, it was privately owned. It was attached to the Griswold Hotel that Morton Plant built. Morton Plant hired Donald Ross to build the course, renovate it, and made it one of the best courses in the country. And it was a premier destination. You know, you have the Harvard-Yale Regatta in the river. That's the oldest regatta in the country. Everybody would bring their yachts here and anchor their yacht right outside the hotel, and then they would hang out here in the summertime.
I should mention it's the Thames River, spelled as the Thames in London, but pronounced Thames. And for people who are into architecture, look up the Griswold Inn, because it was a, 400-room hotel. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it was enormous. I mean, I've gotten all sorts of postcards of it. When I go out, we go, me and my wife go antiquing, so I found a lot of postcards from the hotel. I got old golf clubs that I found from Alex Smith, who was a pro here, after Ross built the course for 8 years. And but yeah, it's incredible the amount of information that I've dug up about the history of that hotel and the course and what it was like here back in the day, all the famous golfers that have played here, exhibition matches that were held to raise money for the Red Cross. Hagen and Kirkwood had a match against Alex Smith and I forget his partner's name at the moment here, but that's where they debuted the first wooden tee called the Ready Tee.
Yeah, it was on that tour. That's right. It was on that Hagen tour where they debuted wooden tees. Yep.
Yeah, so I have an article that describes that, and I actually have a box of Ready Tees in my office right now. So, you know, just stuff like that. It's cool to unearth and connect yourself to that history, knowing that we're here 100 years later.
And so when you start to do this bunker project, 2009, how does the town respond as far as what do you get for money?
Those two big projects I talked about, the HVAC and the irrigation system, they gave us the money, but they wanted us to pay it back. So we had to, like, give them money from our enterprise fund and put it back into the general fund the years after that. So we ran into an issue where we don't generate enough money to pay that money off. So they're not giving us any more money. So that's why nothing else got done until 2008. So they ended up balancing the books, and we took a different approach. Instead of asking for like $500,000 to do bunkers on the front nine, we asked for $50,000 a year, and they bought into it. So that's why we're kind of on this piecemeal plan, because they would always shoot down $250,000 projects.
Right.
So we just got into $50,000 a year. The first two projects, we addressed the two worst tees on the course, because like I said, the tees were built for 5,000 rounds. Now we're doing 45.
Right.
So on holes 4 and 12, there were ridiculously small par 3 tees that were just, they were dirt.
Right, right. I remember.
So those were the first two tees that we did. And then with those two projects, a couple small bunkers near them we renovated. But the next outlying projects down the road were to address all the greenside bunkers. After those two projects were done, we started addressing green complexes. So we got 10 green complex, 11, 12, 13, 14. We did a greenside bunker on one. And currently we're doing 5 and 7 greenside complexes. The last couple years, we had ARPA money from COVID, so they gave us a bigger chunk of money, so we were able to do fairway bunkers on 3, 4, and 6. And then this project that I just mentioned with 5 green and 7 green and some fairway bunkers between 6 and 7 is actually golf course enterprise fund money. So we're going the other way now. With COVID and the golf boom, we've made enough money where we have a nest egg built up. So the town is not giving us money anymore. They want us to use our own money.
Interesting. So, okay. And so that's allowing you to do more per say fall winter than you did in the past, right? Were you able to do say 2 greens and a fairway, some fairway bunkers at the same time where it's just more than $50,000 worth of work?
Yeah, we're sitting on enough money that we decided to take 200,000 of it and do a project.
Okay. And now, do you have to go to anybody and do you have to go to a board and say, here's our proposal for what we're doing this year?
When we do our budget every year, the CIP component is part of that budgeting process. So you do have to spell out what you're going to do and how much money you're going to use for the next 5 years.
Right.
And then in that CIP budget, it has a column for how you're going to fund it. So it's going to be CIP fund, you know, C for CIP, O for other. So we were CIP, now we're other because we're funding it ourselves. But yes, I still have to spell out what we're going to do in each year, outgoing 5 years, and the council and the RTM have to approve it.
Okay. And then the process is you and Tim sit down or walk the course and say, here's the one that needs it the most. And I'm asking you that in the context of no work has been done on these bunkers in over 100 years.
Yeah, that's exactly how it goes. We just kind of, when we started, we picked the worst ones, and then we just kept going. What's the next worst one that we want to fix right away, you know? And we obviously did focus on greenside first, so we hadn't done any fairway bunkers until the last couple of years.
Right. And okay, now, as far as the work, there's a construction company involved that's been the same construction company for the whole time?
Yes. When we did the first project, we have to go out to bid, being a town, and DHT Golf Services and Tim Garish working with him, they won the bid. So they got the first project. So when we went to the project the next year, instead of going out to bid again, I talked to our purchasing agent. And I said, look, these guys were the lowest bid last year. We're going to be doing these piecemeal projects year after year after year. We need to have the same architect because he did our master plan, and we need to have the same shapers and construction company because it's got to be consistent work throughout the course. If we had to go out to bid every year to get a different contractor and a different architect, I mean, you only know what you've seen, how it could possibly go wrong.
It'd be a disaster, an absolute disaster. And so what is your, what's your crew size in the wintertime?
Year round, I have 5 full-time guys. And okay. In the summer, I bring on a few seasonals. But yeah, 5 in the winter.
So what are your guys doing this time of year? Are they involved in the renovations, what I'm asking?
They are not, no. The contractor does everything. Once they have sod down, then we're responsible for that. So obviously right now, nothing going on, it's cold, but with the drought that we had into November this year, they were laying sod and we were having to water it, which is crazy.
Right.
Yeah, I kept my irrigation system live longer than I ever have into the winter before because we were still watering sod that they were putting down.
Yeah, and with the weather being the way it was, I mean, there was no concern for you of anything freezing, right?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I was more concerned about sod wilting in the middle of November than it getting too cold and not being able to work on the project.
Right. I mean, that's insane. That's something if I told you 6 years ago, or told anybody 6-7 years ago, that they would have thought you're crazy, right? I mean, that you're going to have sod wilt in November.
Yeah, no, absolutely, no.
All right, well, let's do this. Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
From fairway and greens drainage to full-scale renovation work, Golf Preservations can handle your project with ease and give you the peace of mind of knowing the professionals are caring for your valuable golf course assets. Since 2005, Golf Preservations has meticulously installed over 500 miles of drainage pipe on more than 300 golf courses nationwide, always keeping disruption of play to a minimum. Visit golfpreservations.com or call 606-499-2732 to speak with us about your next drainage or renovation project.
Okay, we're back on the TurfNet Renovation Report. I'm with Eric Morrison. He is the golf course superintendent at Shinnecock Golf Course in Groton, Connecticut. We're talking about this ongoing renovation project that you have. So let me ask you about this. In essence, there's a part of your golf course that has new turf every year, right? You're growing in a small portion every year. How difficult is that to be maintaining new turf? And like, you know, you're not going in order. You're jumping around the golf course. So you have some holes down by the water. You have some holes that are much further inland. How difficult is it for you to be maintaining new turf every year?
I mean, it's nice to have the new turf because the stuff that there was there before was crap, garbage. But you got to pay attention to it. You know, new sod, you don't just put it down and forget about it. You know, we're putting down pre-plant fertilizer before it goes down. Once it gets warm out, we're doing granular wetting agent on that new sod because, You know, some of it doesn't even get hit by sprinklers.
Right.
So until it really knits and gets in, if it's not a wetter spring, early summer, then we got to keep an eye on it. You got to fertilize it more than we're fertilizing other bunkers, just because it's, you know, sod is, you got to keep it fertilized for the first couple of years until it kind of adapts to the new surrounding. So yeah, it gives you one area that you got to put a little more effort into every year. You know, hopefully Mother Nature helps out a little bit, but.
Right. Now, are you getting any kind of pushback from your regular players, because there's always some section of the golf course for at least a part of the year that's roped off and out of play and ground under repair?
Yeah, sometimes it depends on when we do the projects. You know, like right now we have two temporary greens out there, but it's December 18th, so they get over it pretty quick.
Right.
You know, when we had done the project last spring, the fairway bunkers on 3, 4, and 6, that was kind of as the season was ramping up. So, yeah, it was a little tricky for them to be playing so many bunkers that are ground under repair.
Right.
But that time of the year, the sod knits pretty quickly. So it wasn't a big stretch of time like this is going to be all winter for these two greens.
Right.
But, you know, I think they appreciate the work that we're doing. They see the golf course improving year after year. So I think it actually gets them more excited to play.
Yeah, I could see that, especially having seen some of the work you've done and reclaiming some of the sizes and footprints of the old bunkers and reestablishing some things. I mean, it's a wonderful golf course, and then just the improvements have made it that much better.
Yeah, it definitely has. You know, using the old aerial photographs from the 1934 that Connecticut did to make sure that we're getting the shapes correctly, you can, you know, Dan, the contractor, once he starts peeling back the old grass and getting into the soil, you can almost see when he's digging where the sand ends and where the subsoil is. So not only the shape is almost already under the turf already once you start moving earth, but the height of the outgoing lip, you know, we had some that were 6 or 7 feet high, and it's interesting to watch him start digging that stuff out. And when you find the subsoil line, how far down the original bunker really was.
Well, when I was out there, was it 2 weeks ago, when you were showing me that bunker on, it was on 7, right? And it was a front right greenside bunker. And it was obvious that there was a foot and a half of sand built up over the 108 years.
Right. Yeah. Any bunker on a green that's short right, those are the ones that were built up the most. We had one on 10. And a couple front bunkers on 13 that were just ski slopes. I mean, they were ridiculous. And the one on 13 was funny because we cut them down in-house. And then when we did the project, they went down even more. And one of our members was playing on a weekend, and he got there. It was the first time he'd seen it. And he flipped out and went on a rant saying, I ruined the course, and I took the teeth out of that green. And I mean, you know, the green is tiny.
Yeah.
It's surrounded by bunkers. It's a hard short par four. It's like those bunkers only made it 100 times harder than it was ever intended to be. So, but yeah, it's cool to go to each project and see what he's going to find when we start digging, you know, finding old clay tile drains or whatever.
Right. Right. So, you know, when you look back at the aerial, you have some great photos from the 34 aerial. You have some ground level stuff, like you said, from the postcards and some magazine articles that you've shown me. Is there some agronomic or architecture decisions that are made because of the manpower situation that you have? Like, you're going to be triplexing greens instead of walk mowing them, as far as where your grass lines are going to be, what your slopes on your bunkers are going to be. Are you making decisions off of your manpower and your capabilities?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we're not touching any green surfaces. I think the only one we touched was 13 when we did that front right bunker, because the sand buildup had gotten so far into the green. I think we stripped a part of the green and lowered it a little bit. Definitely collars were doing that.
Sure.
We just have to make sure, like on 7, the project we're doing now, there's a bunker that wraps from the middle the left side of the green all the way around the back. So we just have to make sure that we have enough room to turn a triplex when we're mowing the greens. And because they've been triplex for so long, it's really already there.
Right.
I mean, I have photographs of a lot of the greens before triplexes were invented, and they had some great shapes. And I mean, if I had manpower to walk mow greens, I would totally recapture all those shapes.
Right, right.
Because, like, the sixth green, for instance, was shaped like a home plate on a baseball field. Like a 5-point
No
shape.
Kidding.
And now it's obviously everything's circle now. Right. But yeah, a lot of front squared off greens, you know, like you've seen at Fisher's. They've done a lot of those, putting those back. So yeah, Shenacosta had a lot of those too. But yeah, it was a lot of angles, like sharp angles on corners of greens with their shapes.
Interesting. And what about like bunkers, slopes leading into bunkers?
The pictures that we have, they were pretty steep slopes. You know, I'm kind of getting some pushback from what we're doing now and how steep some of the faces are, and it creates a lot of handwork for us, but we're trying to put it back to what we think was there, and I have photographic evidence that that's how they went.
Right.
If we can soften something and it doesn't take away from what we think was there, so I can get a mower on it, we're trying to do that. But some of them you just can't with the way the shapes are and where they are in relation to the green surface.
And you're trying to get the golf ball into the sand, too. That's the other thing. They have to be steep.
Yeah. No, like the front right bunker we did on 7 there that we were talking about, there was a ribbon of rough around it before. So if your ball was just slowly going, it would hit the rough and stop. So I told Tim, you know, when we redo it, I want to have bent grass around the top, and we'll mow it low, and ball go right in the bunker.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, like when I was talking to Tim on site, right? I mean, you're doing these things where you're grading the bunkers on the backside, on the fairway or the tee side, to get balls into the bunkers. You're getting your mow lines out to get balls into the bunker, but at the same time, it can't be too much because then you don't want water running into the bunker, which was what happened with this massive rain event you had last week.
Right. Yeah, we do the shaping around the rest of the bunker to try to minimize as much sheet flow as possible. We are putting drainage in the bunker where they didn't have them before. So, you know, a lot of the bunkers that we're working on would end up being ponds. Right after that rain event last week, the crew came out to start working on drainage on those fairway bunkers, and they actually had to dig a drain to empty the bunker because it was full of the top of water.
Wow.
So, trying to minimize the sheet flow around it and putting drains in it, definitely going to help. So if you have a spot where you can't bump it because the ball is coming into the bunker, at least we're minimizing the washout areas as much as we possibly can. We're not doing any capillary concrete or billy bunkers or anything like that because we're trying to stretch our dollar as far as we can go.
Yeah, no, and as you pointed out to me and you showed me that, I've seen that photo, is contrary to what somebody would think of you sitting on the ocean, you're not on a sand-based golf course.
No, not at all. No, this is, it's glacial till. I have postcards from back when they were building the course, and just the amount, it just was like a boulder field. It's crazy. And, you know, back then they're moving boulders with a cart with a horse. It's hard to fathom how they got all those boulders off of this property and built the golf course back then.
When you see that photo of that, like it's not like you're looking over the whole golf course, just that small area with all those boulders, and that all those boulders are off that property now is amazing.
Yeah, it's insane.
So as I want to get to, so now you started in 2009, 15 years later, are you at the point where because 15-year-old bunkers, especially at 45,000 rounds a year, are going to need to be redone. Have you got to the point of redoing bunkers that you renovated with Tim, are you still on holes for the first time?
No, we haven't gotten to that point yet. The holes that were built during the Pfizer swap, those bunkers haven't been touched since they were built in 98. And so they're next on the hit list. They all need to be rebuilt. The drainage has failed. There's very little sand in some of the fairway bunkers. So those are the ones that we're going to be getting into the next few years if we continue to have funding to do it. But at some point, like I've discussed with, you know, the powers that be in the town, when we finish, we got to start over. Because there's 100 bunkers on this course. If you're only doing 4 a year, you can do
that.
That's
bad math. That's really bad math.
At least we're getting up into a couple projects the last couple of years that we've done, you know, 10 or 12 or 13 bunkers. We're kind of gaining on them a little bit. But there's still fairway bunkers that we haven't touched. And then all the bunkers from that land swap project haven't been touched yet either. So we have ways to go.
And it's interesting, right? Like what nature's doing. We were looking at that fairway bunker when I was out there with all of a sudden this ledge on the front face of the bunker that you haven't seen before. And now things have to be done to kind of mitigate the fact that it's built on ledge.
Yeah, I mean, at one point there was enough sand in there that we didn't even know it was there. And then years go by, the wind's blowing the sand out and the trap machine is moving the sand around. All of a sudden, hey, there's a piece of ledge.
Yeah.
So I thought it was one of the boulders. So years ago, I don't know how many years ago it was, I sent my guys out with the backhoe to pluck it out, figuring we can just pluck it out. No, we couldn't pluck it out. Yeah, now Dan's the contractor, is working on the bunker actually right now. And he actually found more ledge when he was digging down. The ledge goes like almost through the entire front of the bunker. So that bunker is going to be one instance where we might have to change the shape or the size because of what is underneath that. You know, we're not going to pay to blast it out or
right.
drill it out. So we were just planning on burying the part of the ledge that we knew was exposed. But now it goes further out and further up. So depending on what we can do, if we can put enough sand in there to bury it, that would be great and keep the shape that we were going to have. But we might have to make that bunker smaller depending on what happens with his with the topography of the floor of the bunker and it. If he can go deep enough to get the drainage in and all that stuff.
And you know, we talked about you haven't done much work other than 13 on the green surfaces. I mean, you've got grass on those greens that goes back to 1916, right?
Oh, yeah, no question. Yeah, there's old German bents in there, and you can see them turn purple this time of year. And,
yep.
You know, who knows what else they used back then. But, yeah, there's a hodgepodge of grass out here. A lot of POA,
and it does fine, right? I mean, it's adapted to the weather, and when you get your droughts or your warm spells or your cold spells, those greens don't check out on you.
No, the grass has been here way longer than we have. It's definitely adapted. We let people walk on
right.
all winter, you know? So yeah, it's strong stuff.
So what, you know, you've become a real history buff about the golf course. What's it, tell me about your feeling when you look at the 34 aerial, you realize how much has changed. You've seen the photos, ground photos, how much has changed. Tell me about what it's like to restore a golf course back to, you know, this fantastic Donald Ross golf course, restore it to what it, very close to what it was when it opened.
It's rewarding to see the work when we're done and just knowing that we've put the time and the effort into doing it the best we think the way it was, you know, and digging into all the history. You've seen the boards in the golf shop with Glenna Collette on there and Tommy Armour and Alex Armour, Max Marston. So, and digging through all that and then just trying to imagine what it was like back then, knowing that I'm here now and we're trying to, I mean, we're obviously never going to get it back to where it was in the heyday of a private, extravagant facility, but just trying to do our part to keep that history alive and
yep.
and let people know about it. You know, I've posted a lot of stuff on our website that I've found about the history, and we always talk about it whenever we can to get people aware of it, and we just had...
Right.
Our 125th anniversary was last year.
Right.
So we had a display in the library for almost the entire year of all photographs and pictures and trophies, golf clubs. I found Alex Smith golf clubs. So we put a whole display together. We did have help from a gentleman named Alan Welch, who's just, he's a collector of Glenna Colette stuff.
So fantastic.
He actually brought down almost all of his collection and displayed it with everything that we had, and it was just a tremendous display.
Shinnecocket had these pretty amazing, or not pretty, but amazing tournaments, women's and men's, and these boards have these names of these, you know, these household names, Glenna Colette Varr. After she got married, she won it. Glenna Colette, before she got married, she won it. Max Marston. I mean, Arnold Palmer played there when he was at the Coast Guard Academy in New London. It's amazing who was on that golf course.
Well, yeah, Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, you know, all those exhibition matches we were talking about. Marion Hollins won the Griswold Invitational one year, which that tournament at the time was one of the premier amateur tournaments in the country. And, you know, obviously Marion Hollins went on to build her own golf course on Long Island, and she was instrumental with Paso Tiempo and Augusta National too. Cypress Point.
Right. And it's when you go back and you look at the golf magazines from that time, the Shinnecocket women's tournament received incredibly in-depth coverage.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I found articles from obviously the local papers, but the New York Times covered that all the time. I mean, it was national news, that tournament. And I found a picture recently. I think Glenna Colette was getting a trophy, and you could see the board in the background hanging up.
Wow.
So those boards are fairly old.
Yeah, to have them in the pro shop like you have them now, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's one of the first things I do when I go to another course that I know is old and steeped in tradition. I just try to walk around the clubhouse and see what they have. You know, a lot of places have big trophy cases and have the similar boards from different tournaments or club championships or whatever.
It's, and like you said, you know, Alex, so when the course opens after the Ross redesign, Alex Smith, who goes on to win two U.S. Opens, he's the head professional. And then later on, you have Light Horse Harry Cooper, who wins in his career, he wins 30 PGA Tour events, including a Western Open, and he also wins the Canadian Open. I mean, just the two pros you had with there were amazing.
Yeah, and Alex Smith was the teacher for Glenna Colette. I mean, there's the history and the people that were here, and, you know, seeing the pictures of the exhibition matches and all the people following the matches, it's just amazing to think about what happened on this property 100-plus years ago.
Yeah, and I think it's great. It's fantastic that you guys keep the history alive. And it was so good of the library to put up that display. I mean, just to get people in the town to understand what's, you know, that this historic golf course is, you know, sitting right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything we can do to promote ourselves as an asset to the town and the community can only help us out down the road.
Right, and embracing history is, you know, I'm surprised at courses that, you know, that don't do that. It's really good to see courses that appreciate their history and embrace it.
I mean, you have to. It's just trying to dig up all this stuff is so rewarding when you actually find something new. I mean, you know, you guys just found that photo.
Yeah.
What, a week ago?
Yeah, Sean Tully finds a Seth Rayner photo that we didn't know existed from the only one we've ever seen with him and with Charles Blair McDonald, right?
Yeah, when you come across stuff like that, it's just so awesome.
Yep. And I think it's great that the town is all behind your efforts to do that, too. I mean, we've known of other situations where, you know, municipal courses don't get their due or their attention, but to walk in your little pro shop and see those names hanging on the wall is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It would have been nice if a couple of the trophies that I found online that were a few $100 the town would have kicked in some money for, but oh well. I said I tried to put out an email to find somebody who would want to donate it to us after they bought it, but that didn't work out either.
Good try though.
Yeah, right.
Well, listen, I appreciate your time in this. I'm sure you have to get back out on your golf course to make sure that the 100 whatever golfers out there are enjoying the golf course.
Oh, yeah, they're enjoying it all right, driving their carts through all the wet spots where they're not supposed to be.
Well, this concludes today's episode with my guest, Eric Morrison. He is the golf course superintendent at Shinnecassee Golf Course in Groton, Connecticut. And you have been listening to the Renovation Report on TurfNet Radio.